After a tragedy, the man who would be Alpha turns his back on his duty to his people, until his monarch demands a union between him and a woman who knows his secret. Can they build back what was lost together, and maybe find love in an unexpected place? I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. And I can't tell you how excited I am for today's selection. In a first for our podcast, we are returning to a series, The Shifters of the Beau Monde by Susanna Allen. You might remember A Wolf in Duke's Clothing from episode 5. It was the very first to go onto our Gold Star shelf, and you could probably guess how much I love it based on how often I reference this novel. The moment I finished A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, I knew I wanted more. Greedily, I stalked the author's page and was delighted to discover that the second book was on the way. And that is what we are reading today, A Most Unusual Duke by Susanna Allen. Now, if you want a more comprehensive dive into this book, I will actually recommend reading about the Wolf Duke first, and maybe listening to episode 5 to catch up. But I'll give us a quick and dirty tour to get us started. The shifters of this world are known as Versipellis, and they tend to form groups using that now somewhat defunct wolf pack structure that people still argue as stone cold fact. Meaning, there is an alpha, followed by a beta with a gamma beneath them, and finally omegas at the bottom. In this world, omegas are actually quite important, able to change and shift moods around them. Our last novel showed us the Lowell Pack, run by an alpha wolf, that would be Duke Alfred, and until he found his Vera Amoris, or his true love, his entire pack was cursed with infertility, unable to bear any children. Scent seems to be the primary way the alphas can track down their to-be lovers. It is also the height of rudeness to ask a Versipellis what their shifted self becomes. The shifter will decide who can know and when they know. With all that in mind, I will say that this might be one of the book's few shortcomings. We have read more than a few books plucked out from a series on this podcast, and for a majority of our reads, we've not had any problems keeping up. Right now, I have the benefit of knowing what's going on before I start reading A Most Unusual Duke, so it's a little hard for me to judge if someone going in blind would have any challenges. I'm going to take a leap and say that a new reader might have a rough go of it. A Wolf in Duke's Clothing did an excellent job of laying the foundation for this world and its rules. Now its sequel doesn't have to work as hard to follow up, but if someone comes in blind, it might be a bumpy ride. But this is also not a case of a series that has a backlog of 10 to 20 plus books. For now, we will see how A Most Unusual Duke handles the balance between keeping new readers in the loop without boring returning readers like myself. So without further ado, let's get this party started. Our cover is a little different from its predecessor. It still has the same main elements, shirtless man, woman with flowing locks, and the ever-important animal background. But if I'm being perfectly honest, I like the first cover more a little bit than this one. Purple is the dominant color here, offset by our heroine's long blonde hair. Her back faces toward us as she leans into the hero, and he stares out at us with a stern expression. Over his shoulder is the faded image of a bear's face at the top, and below, the windows of a mansion. There's something about this cover that just doesn't quite match the perfection of the first one. I'd have to say that the cover on A Wolf in Duke's Clothing is a little more dreamlike. The edges are softer, details are not so refined. Here, everything feels like a sharp contrast, and doesn't elicit that same moment of excitement that the first cover did. But all that aside, it's time to dive in. We begin with a prologue, with a very young Arthur, only 6 years old and not yet changed for the first time. He's the heir presumptive to become the alpha bear of the Osborne Sleuth. His father, the current Duke and Alpha, has been challenged for the right of leadership by an outsider, and it's not going well. He loses the battle, and Arthur, along with the other sleuth members and cubs, flee. Though the outsider won, the sleuth obviously will not follow him as their alpha. And because an alpha's power comes from his pack, called the Centio, it's a hollow victory, since there is no longer a pack to follow him. And little Arthur makes a vow to never marry and to reject his birthright, allowing the Osborne sleuth to fade apart and letting the ducal lands fall into disrepair from years of neglect. Now we return to our present, and we catch up with Arthur Humphreys, the reluctant Duke of Osborne, as he watches his fellow shifter, the Duke of Lowell, make a rather large fuss as he proposes to Felicity Templeton. We're basically picking up at the tail end of our first novel, getting a side view of the excitement. But Arthur isn't excited at all to be here. He's been ordered by his cousin, Prince George himself, to be present at this veritable crush of a ball. He'd done what he could to separate himself from most of society, including keeping away from his brother Ben and sister-in-law Charlotte. He knew that his presence alone would send titters through the marriage mart, and he will be much more comfortable when he leaves to return to his solitude. Here we might notice that Arthur has a conversation with himself, or rather, his inner bear. The two seem to coexist, rather than the man simply becomes a bear, or at least they are aspects of his personality. Still, we get to see Arthur's bear admonish him for his loneliness. Before long, one of the king's footmen arrives to escort Arthur to see the prince regent himself, and so he has no choice but to oblige. Our focus can now turn to Beatrice, the widow of the Marquis of Castleton. She is also on the sidelines, watching the engagement, and there seems to be a bit of bitterness in our heroine, having lost what others have longed for. Beatrice's figure had always been considered the apex of womanly design. She was small, pleasingly rounded in the correct places, with skin as pale as milk and hair as golden as a freshly minted Guinea. How keen she had been to make her come out, knowing she was a pattern card of female perfection. Pride goeth before a disastrous marriage, and she had enjoyed incomparable status for a very short time before the alliance with Castleton was made. As she watches Felicity dance with Alfred, she worries about her. They weren't fully friends, thanks to the social hierarchy, but Beatrice worries all the same. It seems that she's in on the secret, seeing that her late husband had been a wolf shifter himself. And, unlike the Duke Alfred, he wasn't exactly pleasant. Her life had handed her a great many lessons, such as running a house efficiently with funds to keep her brothers entertained and remain flush, and how to accept a possibly difficult marriage in the hopes of becoming a mother and growing a family. It's just her bad luck that the marriage in question was fraught with more difficulty than most. Beatrice is also summoned by the prince, and she follows without objection. Arthur is a little surprised to see Lady Frost, as she has been called by the ton, to join them. His bear picks up on something, but isn't quick with the details, telling Arthur that there is nothing where something should be. There isn't time to ruminate on this puzzle when Georgie arrives. There is some royal posturing, and then he cuts to the point. He is not happy with Arthur's vow to never wed and carry on his line, and he is especially not happy with the fact that Beatrice holds a dark secret that puts all shifters in danger of exposure. He has to deal with both problems, and has decided to throw a single stone at both. Beatrice thinks that her life is about to become forfeit as she watches these two shifters square off. I'll note here that she doesn't know that they're bears exactly. Her late husband was a wolf, remember, and that's the only kind of shifter she is aware of. But she does know that she toes a dangerous line, harassing both the prince regent and holding the secret over him as her protection. To his credit, even though Arthur isn't exactly fond of Beatrice, or at least her reputation, he does what he can to smooth the cracks between her and Georgie, lest she become a target for some sudden claws. But the prince is not so heartless. He has only decided that Beatrice and Arthur would be married, elevating Beatrice's station and urging Arthur to take his place among his kind and court. When Arthur protests, Georgie threatens to, politically, separate his brother from his wife Charlotte, and thus separate Charlotte from her children. When Beatrice objects to this, Georgie pulls out the ultimate alpha move, the dominatum, this personal aura that forces those around them to either follow or subdue. The threat Beatrice had sensed, the terrifying quiver in the atmosphere, finally erupted and was nothing to what she'd experienced in her marriage. When the Marquis raged and howled and by some class of dark art made the air unbreakable, when she felt her bones were on the verge of crumbling into dust, the stronger she stood and the calmer she remained, the less it affected her. Year after year, rage after rage, she strengthened and he weakened, and she became invincible. Here we get to see how she survived her first marriage, to become a rock in a crashing sea, unmovable, fearless. In a way, she would appear to be the most gracious, the most obedient of wives, but in her obedience, she was rebelling. While Beatrice was practiced with her husband's dominatum, almost to the point of immunity, Georgie, however, nearly knocks her off her feet. Clearly, her late husband was not as powerful as he pretended to be. The prince tells it to her straight. She is not as safe as she thinks she is, as many shifters would rather her disappear. So this is one way that he can protect both her and her wealth. Neither one of them is happy about this, but Beatrice is willing to accept that she's lost and that it's better than death, while Arthur is practically frantic. Georgie announces that they will be married the very next day, moments after Alfred and Felicity have exchanged their own vows. It is a short affair, none of the pomp and circumstance I think we would expect for a ducal wedding, but really they only just met yesterday. Nonetheless, they find themselves at the altar and are quickly wedded. Georgie introduces them to his man Todd, who will be accompanying them to the estate, and they are quickly on their way. In the small confines of a carriage, Arthur converses quietly with his bear about what had bothered it so. Beatrice has no scent. If we recall in A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, Alfred basically launched himself at Felicity the moment a single molecule of her scent wafted into his nose. It's not that Beatrice has a neutral scent, she simply doesn't have a scent at all. How strange. As far as this setup goes, I think I like it a little more than the setup from the first novel as well. Felicity was all but forced into her relationship by Alfred's ego, and he was breaking all of the rules of the marriage mark to get what he wanted. Here we have a fast wedding before any romance is had, but it's not as if this was a marriage of convenience. This fits within the context of the novel, when a love match was still an unconventional thing, and marriages were more for politics than love. Neither Arthur or Beatrice are happy about the union, so they find themselves on equal ground. It'll be a matter of how they finally come together. But Arthur isn't making it easy on himself. On what is already a tense carriage ride filled with forced small talk, he states that they will partake in a white marriage, basically marriage without physical consummation of the union. This does not bode well for the spicy rating, but I won't be so quick to give up hope. His declaration does nothing to help Beatrice's mood, especially since they had established that her marriage of 5 years had yielded no children. Thus, she believed herself barren and quashed any hopes that she had had for a family. Even Arthur's bear was harassing him for his idiocy. When the literal animal inside you calls you an idiot, you should probably take its word for it. When they finally arrive at Arcadia, they are met with the sight of the ducal mansion nearly falling apart. Beatrice is internally thrilled, and Arthur completely misses the signs. Carefully, he leads her up to the crumbling steps of the door. Arthur raised a hand to knock and saw the flinch, so minute, and yet there. By the gods, could he resurrect that poxed wolf, he would, and see Castleton straight back to Helheim, or whatever constituted the lupine infernal place. He opened his palm to bash against the door. I love this passage because it gives us so much with so little. First, we see Beatrice betraying more of her time with Castleton. Clearly, he was physically abusive, if only a small gesture was enough to get a reaction out of her, small as it was. Arthur's got a lot of work ahead of him. And, for his point, even if he was resentful of the situation, he's not holding it against Beatrice. Indeed, we've seen him ready to leap to her defense, even though there wasn't an emotional connection yet. It gives us a clear look that no matter what Arthur was, he was at least a decent and honorable man. They meet the house staff, who have stayed beyond the point of duty, and Beatrice showers them with appreciation and kindness. Arthur, shocked at the show of emotion from his Lady Frost, goes on to inspect the house. It looks just as unstable inside as it did outside, and they clearly have a lot to do. Beatrice gets herself acquainted with the staff over tea and cookies, and begins the work of having the nicest room converted into the ducal suite. Arthur makes an appearance, notices the single bed in the room, and bolts. Beatrice doesn't seem too bothered, however. She prepares for bed and talks to a small nightingale outside her window, telling it the story of how she discovered the world of the Versipellis. And a clue that something is amiss in the lands of Arcadia, the bird nearly getting smooshed by an unseen predator. The next morning, as she's talking to her lady's maid, she sees another creature outside her window, but a bird it most surely is not. He rose from the weeds and the tangled growth like an Elgin marble statue come to life. She had made a point in her widowhood to partake in what she'd missed while she immured in North Sunderland, and cultural touchstones such as the British Museum had played a part. But the Duke was as far from a cold, remote statue as a man could be. His shoulders were akin to those of Atlas, broad enough to shoulder the earth. They made an extraordinary contrast to the fineness of his midriff. Beatrice ran her eyes up his belly to his chest and to the veritable pelt that lay upon it, a deep, rich brown of a color with his hair, and gazed upon the cut of the muscles beneath. The reference to Atlas is everything, and I think it's appropriate, considering the emotional baggage that Arthur has been carrying on his shoulders all these years. After a slightly tense breakfast, Madam, as Arthur has taken to calling Beatrice, begins the undertaking of bringing Arcadia back to its former glory. Talking with Todd in the steward's office, she gives permission to use her wealth as needed. I'm not entirely sure how the transference of wealth works for a widow in Regency England, but it looks like she is getting £10,000 a year. I won't say that I did the math, because the internet did, but I believe it works out to be the equivalent of 1.2 million Yankee bucks. And considering how the dollar went way farther in 1817, she has got some cash. The big problem is staffing. There are few left in the household, and the ones who are left are somewhat long in the tooth. Still, Beatrice is reveling in the challenge, and is resolute on getting everything sparkling, no matter what might stand in her way. That evening, as Beatrice enjoys a hot bath, courtesy of water brought up by the Duke himself, he has gone and shifted, which apparently is becoming easier for him. He roams the estate, making sure that there's nothing to worry about, but he comes across a smell that is not a smell, much like the way Beatrice smells. Worryingly, the trail leads him to a ruined greenhouse, where he finds Todd, in his fox form, inspecting damage to the greenhouse. I quite enjoy the perspective shift when the alpha changes. As the bear is present in Arthur's mind, Arthur is present in the bear's mind, and the bear is amusingly protective, if that's the best way to describe it. He refers to Beatrice as my duchess, and is completely devoted to her. He may not have the vera amoris scent, but that does not mean that he would neglect his duchess. It's very sweet, if I am perfectly honest. The scent leads them nowhere, and the bear assumes that it, and the greenhouse damage, was left over from Halbjorn's destruction. That was the bear who had killed Arthur's father, now hopefully long gone. As the days go on, Beatrice settles into a comfortable routine, thriving in the effort to bring Arcadia back to life. Only a couple of things have gone amiss. Most frustratingly, not all of her effects have completely arrived, namely some soaps and oils that she was keen to use. Still, she doesn't let it get her down. It's finally decided that they need to call upon more help if they are to fix the roof, among other things. And since Alfred, our beloved Wolfie Duke of Lowell, happens to have a plethora, if not excess, of footmen, they are the suggested solution. The next scene is lifted directly from our previous novel, the epilogue from A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, where Felicity and Alfred are discussing the sudden union between our current two mains. Felicity, concerned for Beatrice, insists on sending her a letter. I've seen more than my fair share of novels where later printings would include a chapter from the next book in the series. Harlequin is especially notorious for this. They want to entice new readers into other books so that they leave teases at the ends of most of their novels, even though they're not necessarily related to each other. But I like the inclusion of the epilogue here. Some might consider it lazy writing, but I certainly don't. For the narrative, it fits within the context of A Most Unusual Duke and gives readers something to look forward to when they finish A Wolf in Duke's Clothing. And for fans of our first pairing, myself certainly among them, any extra time spent with Alfred and Felicity is a plus. Instead of getting a typical first chapter tease, we get something that helps knit the two books together in a clever bit of rearrangement. More surprises are in store when Arthur's brother and sister-in-law show up with cubs in tow. Ben and Charlotte are pretty straightforward in calling their whole group of theirs a sleuth, despite all of Arthur's protests. They are also quick to pick up on Beatrice's scent, or rather lack thereof. But they take Arthur's barbs in stride and don't waste any time in making themselves at home. I quite like the image of poor Arthur watching his carefully laid plans of permanent lonerhood crumble around him faster than his house. I mean, I don't relish his discomfort, but shutting himself away from his family was clearly not doing him any good. We need to resolve some trauma, and since therapy was not a thing in Regency England, this is the best method we've got. Charlotte, or Charlie as she insists, is quick to make friends with Beatrice, and Beatrice gets the shock of her life. The topic of children comes up, and Charlie informs our dear Beatrice that it does not matter her situation. If Alfred so deems it, she will have children. I suspect that this subject is probably a bit touchy, the idea of infertility being solved with magic, but it's part of the lore in this world. The elves are able to call down children, as Charlie describes it, so their family groups can flourish. And it also has a handy side effect as proper birth control. Wouldn't mind that aspect in all honesty. Much as we enjoyed the slice of life aspect from the previous book, it's a return to form here, and I'm the happier for it. It helps flesh out the pacing and establishes the character connections that help make our story all the more real, shapeshifters aside. Time passes, people get to know one another, and the footmen from the Lowell estate arrive. Their appearance shows us that the house can and will return to form. Beatrice and Arthur are getting a little closer. Not quickly, mind you, these things should take time, but it is moving forward. With Beatrice now aware that Arthur can easily give her the family she hopes for, the idea of expanding the terms of their marriage begins to take root, and it causes her to reflect on her previous marriage. As I was reading this novel, I hadn't found a moment, anything really, that might make it stand out on my shelf, other than being a very well-written romance novel. It was already high on my rating list, but I wasn't sure if it was going to hit the tops of my expectations. And then I came upon this conversation between Charlie and Beatrice. Beatrice confides in Charlie that the marital relations between her and Castleton were harrowing, and she had been begun to believe that it was not done properly. Beatrice has probably been very lonely up till now. Her status as a widow had not made her easy to approach in society, and it was only now that she could consider Felicity as a true friend after several letters between them. She has not had anyone, least of all any female friends, in whom she could confide. So poor Beatrice has been thinking herself lacking in her inability to bring forth any children, when the reality has been far from the truth. Like any straightforward friend would, Charlie helps Beatrice get to the bottom of the problem. Beatrice scoffed, and to her horror, crumbs flew out of her mouth. I can think of no one less innocent than I. Untouched, then, in any way that signifies. But there was... It was not... I cannot call it bed play, but he visited my rooms and came into the bed with me, and... She could not go on. My dear, you are the epitome of refinement, and I shudder to lower the tone. Charlotte took a deep breath and asked, Did he put his cock into your cunny? Beatrice brushed at the crumbs in her lap. There were, of course, attempts at entry. I do not believe he was successful. And I could not stop applauding. I have never, ever considered that there would be a conversation about sexual education in any of these novels. Oh, sure, we can find those tired cliches of women being shown a whole new world, but that is not what sex ed is. Again, we are getting a plot point that fits within the context of our setting. Sex ed was not readily doled out as needed. It barely is today. So it's not unbelievable that a woman who has had two unwilling marriages would have no idea what sex is supposed to entail. And she isn't educated by a big, strong man, but by a woman she is brought into her confidence as a friend. It's amazing! Oh, and I have to say, the English have such a way with words, don't they? Arthur is finding it harder and harder to resist her, so he decides that he should do the proper thing as her husband and give her the children she so readily desires. He approaches her room, states his purpose, and she agrees. It won't interfere with their white marriage, right? Surely not. Arthur seems aware that she is a bundle of nerves, so he's careful and checks in with her constantly. She lays down a boundary, no kissing, and he obeys. This. We need more of this. As they settle in for some post-coital cuddling, Arthur lets slip that he is a bear, but oops, Beatrice has already fallen asleep. Time marches on in our story. Like I said earlier, there's a lot of slice of life here. We watch the house be mended, alongside relationships. Arthur and Beatrice spar with one another, but not in any resentful way. We watch the children, Tarbin, Bernadette, and Ursula, thrive in their new home. There's a lot that happens, but nothing that I am not enjoying. Some might find this aspect of the novel boring, but I am reveling in it. Like a cat sitting in cream, I could not be more content. As things take better shape, Arthur can feel his Centio flowing, even though he doesn't have a beta. Does he? It's not his brother Ben, as named Garbin for his role to be Gamma. In case anyone forgot, names have a purpose in this world. Alphas, betas, and the like are named appropriately. Little Ursula is an outlier, and she is showing to be an Omega. But we have Arthur, our Alpha, Garbin, like I said. Who could be the Beta? Well, when Beatrice has finally had enough of Todd's mischief, it becomes apparent to us, if not our stubborn Alpha. Todd, at the direction of Georgie, has been causing a few things to go amiss in order to bring our pair together. Beatrice took the lead in admonishing the fox, but knew him to be diligent and dutiful. So instead of a full-out punishment, he gets a tongue-lashing and an offer of employment as the steward permanently at Arcadia. Just because she cannot shift does not mean she cannot take up the beta's duties, and Beatrice seems to slip into the role easy as can be. I think the book refers to them as an alpha pair, but the rules are still followed to a point. Arthur's a little shook about everything that's transpired, but Charlie comes out to give him that ever-important come-to-Jesus talk. Or should it be come-to-Beatrice talk? She encourages him to share with Beatrice what had happened to his father all those years ago, and what had led him to abandon Arcadia. Thankfully, it looks as though he is receptive to her suggestions. He visits Beatrice one night, and they share about their families, their pasts, and it finally looks as though the first rays of affection are shining through. They don't share the bed that night, but they still part with warm words. The next morning, everything changes. Beatrice gets ready for the day, but her routine is disrupted in just the smallest of ways. An oil that she uses daily, meant to help her fertility, had run empty, so she wasn't able to apply it as normal. And Arthur has noticed something different. Everywhere Beatrice went, she sees the staff have a strange reaction to her presence, though she's not sure why. And when she reaches the kitchen for breakfast, it's apparent that something has changed, given how everyone was staring. A noise outside alerts them all, and Arthur all but crashes into the kitchen. "Good morning, Osborne. We had wondered where you..." Beatrice began as she made to rise, and he flew across the room to loom over her. He looked wild and disheveled and larger than usual, his curls a riot on his head, his falls hanging by one button. He dropped to one knee, and his eyes were glittering and wild and flashed from his warm brown and the fiery golden yellow of his creature, and back again. The rumble in his chest sounded like a struck bell, and grew in strength and volume. She refused to fear his creature, even if she had no idea what it was. And he sits there and takes a big ol' whiff of our Duchess. Just as suddenly as he arrived, he bolted out of the kitchen, leaving Beatrice to carry on with her morning. That passage is probably one of my favorites. We get the image of Arthur as a man struck by lightning, almost, urged by some unseen presence, and Beatrice waiting to understand exactly what her Duke is up to. We follow Arthur out the door, still in his human form, and witness the frolicking, yes, frolic in the euphoria of having found his vera amoris, and in the flowers. Later on that day, Arthur had not yet returned, and Beatrice got the deets from Charlie and Ben. Charlie asked if there was something that she had changed in her day, and Beatrice tells her about the oil, how she was urged to apply it every day after she was married to Castleton in order to ensure children. Ben, talented with oils and soaps and the like, smells the empty bottle and tells her that it's neem oil. Its main purpose is to mask scents so that shifters could hide themselves if they wished, and a side effect was, in fact, pregnancy prevention. Explains a lot, doesn't it? Armed with this information, Beatrice walks out of the house, following the path that she had seen Arthur take. She sits on a boulder and speaks, even though she doesn't see anyone there. She talks about the oil and asks him if he could help explain what happened that morning. At her urging, Arthur shows himself to her, in bare form, attempts to intimidate her, fails, and shifts back into his human skin. Of course, he's naked, and the usual Regency shyness dominates their conversation. They agree to meet again that evening over dinner, and dinner inevitably leads to sex. Arthur also learns why Beatrice didn't like kissing, and it was simply because any time she was kissed, it was a horrible experience. Rest assured, he fully changes her mind on the subject, but he doesn't go about this in the way that you would expect. Arthur took her hand and raised her palm to his lips. "If I may in turn demonstrate." He brushed his mouth over her hand and her pulse leapt. "You may." "Oh dear." Arthur opened his mouth and ran it along her palm, his lips warm, his breath hot but not unpleasantly so. Was it pleasant? Pleasant did not begin to describe it. It was gentle yet invigorating. It weakened her knees and made her feel hot and tingly between her thighs. Arthur is so respectful of her boundaries. He doesn't assume that she will be receptive to an assault on her mouth when she clearly hasn't ever had a nice experience with kissing. He first shows her, in a way that doesn't fully invade her space, what he intends to do. Every time they come together for sex, he is checking in with her, making sure that she is not being coerced or pushed beyond her comfort zone. And we can still get that thrill of a dominating man with his partner, given that she's still new to everything in a way. There is excitement in his care. I'm not sure how to explain it. just know that I love it. We get a small perspective shift, surprisingly, to little Ursula. Among her siblings, she is quiet but insightful, proving her future as the Omega. She knew what was up when Arthur smelt his Vera Amoris for the first time, so she goes out on a hunt for the proper flowers to mark the occasion. Except, something has been stalking her. We can safely assume that we are about to hit our action climax for this story, centered on rescuing the girl. It's not long before the family realizes she's missing, and quickly, Arthur puts clues together. There had been small animals left as warnings, a patch of neem carefully cultivated to hide scent. It's hypothesized that Halbjorn is the culprit, long waiting for a chance to keep his claim on the Osborne sleuth. Word is sent to both Duke Alfred and Prince George that the usurper may still lurk, and the search continues for Ursula. Beatrice is the first to find Halbjorn in his bearskin, and unfortunately, she is alone. But when she sees Ursula, she is cool and collected, talking as though there was no danger. Soon enough, they are joined by Prince George, Alfred, Arthur, the Osborne sleuth, and another shifter we have not fully met yet. Halbjorn is very much outnumbered. Arthur tries to grab Ursula, which provokes Halbjorn, and she shows off her power as Omega by putting him to sleep, so that he may be safely dealt with. Georgie takes on that burden, and the rest are left to leave. The falling action sees us back at Arcadia, bustling with life and friends. Beatrice, Charlie, Felicity, and a newcomer to the group, Tabitha, all partake in the drinking and spilling of tea. There's also more discussion on sex ed for Beatrice's benefit, so more cheers from me. We also catch up with the menfolk, talking about their respective mates, as well as get a small introduction to the Duke of Fluellen, whom I suspect will be the focus of the next novel. Everything begins to draw to a close. We get one last sex scene where Arthur bestows his bonding bite and calls upon his deities to gift Beatrice with children. And then they all gather for a ceremony out on the grounds where Arthur formally claims Beatrice as his Vera Amoris and his Beta in front of nearly every shifter that we've met so far from both novels. I can't imagine a better way to tie up this novel, and personally, I shouldn't try. Now, how can I sum up my feelings for A Most Unusual Duke? Well, there's a lot to go over, I think. I made a lot of comparisons to the first novel, but mostly I really couldn't help it. There were so many wonderful callbacks and treats dropped in that I couldn't resist. For the most part, I think the novel can stand on its own, but so much groundwork is laid out in A Wolf in Duke's Clothing that one would be remiss to go without it. And of course, it is a great book, so I'll recommend you read it anyway. Before we go over anything else, though, let's get into Heather's final score. Our cover will get a 4 out of 5. It didn't elicit the same reaction that I had when I laid eyes on A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, but it's still a good cover. However, it loses a couple of points for how sharp it is, in my opinion. And I really hate to say it, but the back of the woman's dress looks an awful lot like it has a zipper, and considering that zippers wouldn't be popular for like another century, we have to take the ding. Drama, I think, might get a 4 out of 5, but only barely. It didn't have the pressure from the last novel, but that's not to say that there wasn't a threat for our couple to face together. This story didn't focus on regency rules as much as it did shifter rules, and I appreciated the change. It's no good if we get the same story over and over again. Romance will get a very rare 5 out of 5. Yes, our two mains might have been forced into marriage by a prince out to reestablish proper pacts and sleuths, but again, Regency England. Marriage was political more often than not, but Beatrice and Arthur were allowed to come into their romance organically. I appreciated the fact that Arthur was unaware that Beatrice was his Vera Amoris until they had begun to form a romantic bond. They were allowed to take their time with each other and learn about one another. How to go about our spice level now? Well, I'm going to give it a respectable 4. There was something else about the way the sex was written in this book that we don't usually get. While Beatrice was late to the party as far as marital relations were concerned, she was not without her guides. I'm thrilled that she was able to discuss with both her friends and Arthur about her needs and concerns. Furthermore, Arthur was enthusiastic about respecting her boundaries and ensuring that he still had her consent. And finally, near the end of the novel, we get a conversation between the women about having proper orgasms. Sure, the sex in the book might be what we would call vanilla, but that doesn't mean it was boring. World building will get a 4 out of 5. I believe it stands rather well on the foundation laid in the first novel, but I would like to think that a reader new to the series won't have too difficult of a go of it. Something I don't think that I mentioned was that Arthur and the Osborne sleuth called upon the Norse pantheon, while Alfred and his pack called on Romans gods. I appreciated the change, and I think it fits well within our bear-shifting society. Now, for realism, that's certainly a sticky proposition. Just like the first book, I can't give full marks because, to the best of my knowledge, shifters do not exist. However, the people, the setting, the relationship felt real. Personalities were established and everyone interacted and reacted to their surroundings in a completely believable fashion. The narration did wonders for the realism aspect as well. Again, that flowery language of Regency England shines through and puts me in the mind of these high-class nobility. So like last time, I will give a neutral 3 out of 5. Really, in the end, I enjoyed A Most Unusual Duke just as I enjoyed the first in its series. There was so much that I didn't really have a chance to go over, thanks to that slice of life aspect. For instance, Arthur has a love of Shakespeare, which certainly endeared me to his character, and how the children interacted with Beatrice, bringing life into their home. And I'll say again that this book approaches sex in a way so unlike other novels that we've read. That part alone rockets this book to the top of my list. I highly recommend you give this book a read, and you can bet that I will be waiting for the moment the sequel is released. For my final score, A Most Unusual Duke will join its predecessor on the Gold Star shelf with 5 Bardic-inspired bears out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show was written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.